With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, Brian German will lead us through the day's AgNet West headlines. But our top story today, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently affirmed a district court permanent injunction prohibiting California's Proposition 65 warning requirement related to glyphosate. Proposition 65 is a right-to-know law that is intended to enable Californians to make informed choices about exposures to chemicals that cause cancer or reproductive effects. The proposition did not ban the use of glyphosate in the state. California attempted to apply Proposition 65 to glyphosate in 2017, following the 2015 ruling by the International Agency for Research on Cancer that glyphosate is an animal carcinogen and a probable human carcinogen. The National Association of Wheat Growers welcomed the court's response of a permanent injunction. NOG President Brent Cheyenne says California's Proposition 65 requirement threatened the use of glyphosate by requiring false and misleading labels on products that may contain glyphosate. NOG was joined by 11 other agricultural organizations in the case, including CropLife America and the National Corn Growers Association. USDA is investing $70.2 million in the Specialty Crop Research Initiative to support nearly two dozen research and extension projects. USDA Deputy Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small announced the funding on a call with reporters and described what kinds of projects will be funded.
The awarded projects address key challenges of national, regional, and multi-state importance to the food and agriculture industry, including conventional and organic food production systems. The Specialty Crop Research Initiative prioritizes projects that improve crop characteristics, manage threats from pests and diseases, improve production efficiency, profitability, and technological innovation, and it mitigates food safety hazards.
She said it's part of a new effort to further support the U.S. specialty crop sector and increase the competitiveness of its products, as demonstrated by a project in Michigan.
There's 21 projects that have been announced. And just a few examples include Michigan State University, which is using it to increase competitiveness and sustainability of the U.S. blueberry industry by developing methods to improve fruit quality and reduce crop loss. As you know, the blueberry industry does face challenges when it comes to being competitive globally, and so this is an opportunity to invest there.
She also stressed the importance of the extension offices in research.
One of the things that USDA does that I'm most proud of is linking the research to the implementation. And the extension service is such a crucial part of that. Cooperative extension agents are trusted partners who live in the communities they serve, whether it's learning how to make your pecan meatier in Georgia or addressing challenges with citrus greening in Florida or water management in Arizona. All of these are opportunities to connect the research that's being funded by USDA to the work on the ground.
The grant program is administered by USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture. In addition, over the next several months, USDA leadership will engage directly with the specialty crop industry and producers to gain feedback on how the department can better address gaps in services and better meet the industry's needs. Dates and locations of roundtables and other live opportunities for stakeholder feedback are yet to be announced. Fall harvested crops reflect a month-over-month rise in production forecasts per USDA's November crop production report. Rod Bain has more.
What do USDA's latest adjustments to its fall harvested crop production forecast look like for November? The Thursday report from the National Agricultural Statistics Service shows a 1% month-over-month adjusted increase in forecasted corn production. If that holds, that would be a new record for domestic corn production. The rise is fueled by an almost 2 bushel per acre increase in yields from October. Soybean production also rose from the previous month. The 1% increase in November comes in part from a slight increase in bean yield from last month's projections. The all-cotton forecast for this month rose 2% at over 13 million bales. Again, higher adjustments in cotton yield contributed to the production forecast, with USDA reporting a 16-pound yield increase from the previous month. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. In today's national spotlight, recent dry conditions in much of the nation are reflected in the latest USDA Topsoil Moisture Condition Report. Here's Rod Bain with more.
The weather pattern of this past week and its impacts on topsoil moisture for the period ending November 5th.
We are seeing a pattern where it's slightly drier over the last week, so our very short to short rating for topsoil moisture nationally has increased to 40%. That is up from last week's 39%. At the same time, topsoil moisture rated surplus currently stands at 5% of the country. That is down from 7% last week.
Meteorologist Brad Rippey says USDA's latest topsoil moisture condition report includes notes on wet conditions in a small part of the nation.
Most of the remaining wetness is focused from the lower Great Lakes region into New England. It's been an area that's been pretty wet of late. We still see numbers coming in as high as 63% surplus in Vermont. And we also, as you move westward into the eastern Corn Belt, 25% surplus in Michigan. But that is down from last week's 48%. So it is drying out there.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
It's difficult to get the funding needed to research problems in agriculture, even more so in a low-income country. But a group aims to help with that. David Geiger has this report.
Climate change adaptation, nutrition, and farm income are all key research goals of scientists around the world. But in countries like Ghana, it's harder to get a grant. Grow Further is a nonprofit looking to change that by connecting people. Peter Kelly is chair of Grow Further and says they have two projects going on right now, developing an app in Tanzania for farmers to identify crop disease in maize and a Bambara groundnut breeding project in Ghana.
This is to create the first commercial variety of this crop, which has long been neglected in research. It's nutritious. It works well under adverse conditions. It improves the lives of women farmers. It has a lot of advantages, but low yields and neglected from a research perspective. So developing the first commercial variety will make a big difference.
Kelly says the project starts with a social question of what's needed. Then it will move towards breeding and agronomy, ag extension and innovation platforms, scaling up adoption, and ultimately seed commercialization.
Private seed companies selling the seeds not only in Ghana but also elsewhere. Developing value-added products like this Bambara groundnut milk that we have on the table here.
At the World Food Prize, the Grow Further booth held samples of what better funding could bring. Kelly says farmers and scientists want to grow crops but don't have the resources. The mission is connecting both to spread better agriculture. He says in the grant process, they're looking for scalable projects with open-ended announcements and broad goals.
And say, agricultural scientists around the world, send us your best ideas. And what we mean by the best ideas is there's a lot of good ideas out there, but some of them have a strategy for reaching scale, like they're really engaged with farmers, so it's what farmers want. And they're also engaged with key stakeholders like government and the private sector to help it reach scale.
There are other projects on the horizon, like improving the iron content of purple millet. And despite being a new nonprofit, they've seen lots of applications.
We got 700 applications in response to our first grant announcement, which is kind of unusual for a new grant maker, but it shows just how much demand there is for the kinds of overlooked projects that we're looking to fund. So there's lots of good ideas in the pipeline.
Kelly says there are plenty of different ways to get involved as a member, volunteer, or donor.
This is really a lot of what we're about, is connecting people and ideas for a food secure future. So most of our funding comes from individuals, and those individuals can help with reviewing projects and visiting projects, meeting scientists.
Kelly adds those volunteer opportunities are of high value and include reading grant applications.
We really want to engage people in a way that is kind of difficult right now. There are lots of medical research charities out there that people donate to and volunteer for. There's food banks that take more of a short-term approach to food security. But if you want to support the future of food security, it's not easy to get involved, and we're working on changing that.
If you want to learn more about the organization, you can find it online at growfurther.org. I'm David Geiger.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, this week the National Milk Producers Federation strongly objected to the Food and Drug Administration's discussion of plant-based milk and yogurt alternatives in the agency's draft guidance. That guidance, called Questions and Answers About Dietary Guidance Statements and Food Labeling, Draft Guidance for Industry, was published by the FDA in comments submitted back on September 25th. According to NMPF, dietary guidance statements can be used on food labels to provide consumers with information about food or food groups that can contribute to a nutritious dietary pattern to help consumers make healthier choices. So NMPF's comments supported the use of consensus statements from authoritative bodies as the basis for dietary guidance statements by requested clarification on food group equivalents. NMPF also questioned FDA's approach to plant-based milk and yogurt alternatives, saying it will encourage false and misleading advertising, which FDA has already acknowledged as an issue in their draft guidance for the labeling of plant-based milk alternatives. In their comments, NMPF wrote, despite the agency's instructions to use consensus statements from authoritative bodies in developing guidance statements, FDA appears to violate its own principle by describing a means by which a plant-based alternatives other than fortified soy could make dietary guidance statements based on consensus statements about the dairy group. Now, NMPF's comments on the proposed guidance for dietary statements is just one small part of the organization's broader campaign against the mainstreaming of plant-based beverages as legitimate dairy alternatives. You can learn more about this on the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. And the joint annual meeting of the National Milk Producers Federation and its checkoff group partners, National Milk and Dairy Management Incorporated, will be held November 12th through 15th in Orlando, Florida. More than 750 participants will get updates on the breadth and depth of activities that are being conducted. They range from marketing and promotion to policy and analysis. Guest speakers during the four-day event include Terry Jones, the founder of Travelocity.com and chairman of Kayak.com. He'll speak on the leveraging disruption and innovation as technology and consumer tastes continually evolve. Other guest speakers include Eric Clavetter from the Mayo Clinic. He'll speak on the advancing dairy's health benefits. And Carrie Delaney with General Mills, who will assess on how dairy plays an essential role in providing health and wellness solutions through new product marketing channels. Plus, all attendees will be participating in a series of four rotating breakout sessions that are designed to provide a deeper dive into key areas of work for both NMPF and DMI. One of those sessions is titled Remodeling Federal Dairy Policy. They're going to be updating federal orders and the Farm Bill. This will cover an assessment of how and why NMPF has developed two blueprints this year to improve the future direction of dairy policy. To learn more about this event coming up next week, go to the NMPF website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news and farm features when we come back. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Brian German.
At the China-U.S. Sustainable Agricultural Trade Forum and contract signing ceremony in Iowa, the China ambassador and U.S. agricultural industry leaders emphasized shared responsibility and the significance of innovation and collaboration. Multiple Chinese agriculture companies and U.S. commodity exporters signed 11 purchasing agreements and contracts during the event last month. According to the U.S. Soybean Export Council, purchases were mainly soybeans but also included corn, sorghum, and wheat. Among the notable deals were agreements between companies like ADM, Cargill, and CHS with various Chinese counterparts. The contracts, valued at multiple billions, signify gains from trade and confidence in sustainable production. China, as the world's most populous country and second largest economy, is the world's largest importer of U.S. agriculture exports. The Regional Conservation Partnership Program improvement effort that launched last fiscal year is currently ongoing. USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service Chief Terry Cosby said they are working to build capacity, streamline programs, and focus on partnerships.
Based on our partners listening sessions and employee and partner survey, NRCS identified key focus areas for improvement. We now have 7 dedicated teams working on simplifying and reducing the number of agreements, reducing lengthy RCPP easement transitions, improving the RCPP portal, consistent guidance and training for employees and partners, simplifying the technical assistance structure, improving the conservation desktop, and simplifying the partner reimbursement process. Keep an eye out in the near future for more exciting updates from our CPP improvement efforts teams. Another key change this fiscal year is that we're expanding our climate smart agriculture and forestry mitigation activities list. We're offering a bigger toolbox of climate smart activities to help farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners to better conserve America's natural resources. This expanded list will enable us to invest Inflation Reduction Act funding in more climate smart activities on working lands across the country. The in-demand practices on this list have measurable climate benefits as well as other benefits to natural resources like soil, water, and air.
It's been a good year for California rice. President and CEO of the California Rice Commission, Tim Johnson, said it's not just growers having a good year.
We had a year where we had adequate water and could plant really a full crop of rice, almost twice what we planted last year. So industry is really happy. Farmers are having a good year. You know, we also have our communities, our dryers, our aerial applicators, all those businesses that are supported by the rice acres also having a good year. And for folks that really pay attention to the habitat value and that great support of the Pacific Flyway that rice provides. You know, all of the waterfowl that are coming down from Canada and Alaska right now actually have rice fields that have been harvested, reflooded, and they've got all that leftover grain. They've got weed seeds. They've got insects in those fields. So all the wildlife that depends on rice is also having a really good year.
Increasing data collection in the supply chain holds a great deal of potential. Senior Director of Strawberry Product Leadership with Driscoll's, Andrew Wolf, described how they're looking at advanced data now and into the future.
I would say, you know, across the board, more and more data is going to be captured through traceability. That is something that we've been able to somewhat be leaders in, others have been leaders in. We're really capturing that and improving our traceability of that clamshell, of that SKU all the way down to what ranch, what variety, what harvester, possibly crew. Being able to understand a lot more of that data as it goes all the way to the customer across the cold chain. We're going to be capturing more and more of that data in a very secure way, in a very safe way, but being able to use some of that anonymous data to be able to say, okay, how's the quality holding up? What actionable data can we make on the field or even all the way to our researchers to be able to develop better genetics, you know, overall better supply chain, better methods of growing, of harvesting, of post-harvest and cold chain? Where can we capture the data, make sure that it's secure, and make sure it's actionable in real time to be able to make the changes that are necessary?
Next week, the Public Policy Institute of California is hosting the 2023 Annual Water Conference in Sacramento. This year's conference is focused on stewarding California's wet years and will be taking place on Tuesday, November 14th at the Sheraton Grand Hotel in Sacramento. The conference will kick off at 9 a.m. with a presentation from Ellen Hannock, Senior Fellow with the PPIC Water Policy Center. The first panel of the day will focus on preparing for floods of the future, with personnel from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Sites Project Authority, and Central Valley Flood Protection Board. Speakers from Sustainable Conservation, the Monterey County Water Resources Agency, and State Water Resources Control Board will be featured on a panel on harnessing more water for the dry times. After the break, the final panel of the conference will cover policies for California's changing water fortunes. It will feature speakers from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, California EPA, and California Natural Resources Agency. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. What are the results within the USDA's latest look at domestic household food security? Rod Bain takes a look.
Food insecurity in the U.S. as of 2022 is up from the previous year. Among the findings in USDA's latest edition of the Household Food Security in the U.S. report,
food insecurity increased from 10.2% in 2021 to 12.8% in 2022.
That's USDA research economist Matthew Rabbit, one of the authors of this year's Household Food Security report.
The annual prevalence rate of food insecurity is determined by many factors, including the economy, federal, state, and local policies, and the individual circumstances of U.S. households. This particular report does not provide an analysis of the possible causal explanations for changes in food insecurity from year to year. However, we do know from prior research that increases in nutrition assistance and other forms of assistance reduce food insecurity.
Looking at the specific food security versus food insecurity percentages in 2022, plus providing definitions for both categories within the USDA report,
87.2% of U.S. households were food secure throughout the year in 2022. And food secure means that these households had consistent access to adequate food for an active, healthy healthy living for all household members throughout the year. The remaining 12.8% of U.S. households were food insecure in 2022, and food insecure households were unable at some time during the year to provide adequate food in terms of the quantity or quality of food for one or more household members due to a lack of resources.
Another category of interest in the annual survey, the percentage of very low food security.
Very low food security occurs when the normal eating patterns of some household members is disrupted at times during the year for one or more household members. So this represents the most severe range of the severity of food insecurity that we can measure using USDA food security measurement system. In 2022, 5.1% of U.S. households had very low food security, and this was statistically significantly higher than the 3.8% that was estimated in 2021 and the 3.9% estimated for 2020.
8.8% of children were food insecure at times in 2022, up from 6.2% the prior year. Rabbit adds,
between 2021 and 2022, we're actually seeing increases in food insecurity among the majority of household demographic groups. So there are very, very few exceptions where we did not see an increase in food insecurity and very low food security.
He also notes the correlation between food and nutrition assistance program participation and food security status.
In this particular report, we find that 55% of food insecure households in our survey reported that in the previous month, they participated in one or more of the three largest federal nutrition assistance programs, which includes SNAP, WIC, and the National School Lunch Program. In addition, we find that roughly 40% utilize SNAP.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Clarifying the terminology of domestic origin, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA is clearing up some requirements in the meat industry. Last year, the USDA Agricultural Marketing Service purchased $800 million worth of meat products for use in nutrition assistance programs, such as free school meals. That meat must fall under the requirements of domestic origin. However, those requirements are confusing to some. In fact, the AMS says the guidelines for procuring beef, pork, lamb, and bison products were not as clear as other commodities. The AMS is clarifying that meat products must be from animals that are born, raised, and slaughtered in the U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this is not a new rule, but rather a clarification of the existing rule.
We're just making sure that people understand, appreciate what it actually means, so there's no confusion. We're reiterating and reinforcing the fact that domestic origin means exactly that. It means everything having to do with that product was done in the U.S.
President Biden has launched a nationwide series of rural events to announce investments to revitalize struggling rural communities. Gary Crawford has more.
Right now and over the next few days, President Biden and members of his cabinet and other senior administration officials are visiting farms, going to dozens of rural communities all across the country. The reason, according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack,
to celebrate the importance of rural America and to reflect the Biden-Harris administration's deep commitment to investment and to improving life and opportunity in rural places.
When rural America does well, when Indian country does well, we all do well.
President Biden kicking off the rural tour activities last week by visiting a family farm in Minnesota, telling his audience there that many rural communities and many small and mid-sized farmers have not been doing that well, with many farmers going out of business and young people fleeing their rural hometowns in search of better opportunities.
I came to office determined to change that.
And toward that goal, the president announced $5 billion in investments to boost farmers and rural economies to make life in rural communities better. For example, the president is investing $1 billion to improve rural infrastructure. Mitch Landrieu is White House infrastructure coordinator, and he says the money will go for things such as
rural roads and bridges, cleaning up legacy pollution, clean and safe drinking water, modern wastewater, protecting communities from drought and wildfire, deploying clean energy, and of course, ensuring every community in America, no matter how rural or remote, has access to affordable, reliable, high-speed internet.
Which hundreds of thousands of rural residents still don't have, putting them at a big disadvantage to those living in urban and suburban areas. And so the president says,
my plan is about investing in rural America. It's about something else as well. It's about restoring pride to rural communities that have been left behind for far too long.
The goal here is to convey a message that rural America matters and that it justifies significant investment.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says many of us consumers really don't realize the important role rural areas play in our daily lives.
All the food, most of the water, most of the power, and most of the iconic landscapes of this country come from rural America. And in addition, a disproportionate number of those who serve us in the military come from rural America. So it's an important place. And it's a place where it ought not to be that moms and dads are having conversations with their children or grandchildren about how there isn't opportunity in rural places and how they need to go to an urban setting or a suburban setting for economic opportunity.
So as the president put it, it's all about
creating new and better markets and new income streams so that generations of rural Americans can begin to thrive again.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Brian German with today's interview segment.
So I'm Dr. Kevin Caffrey with BASF. I'm a tech service rep covering the South Valley of California.
And we recently had an opportunity to speak in person at a local field day. You said it was an interesting year, to say the least, in terms of some of the pest and disease pressures that you've seen earlier just based on some of that weather. So maybe we can start with a little bit of a recap in terms of some of the crops that seem to have some of the most issues or how that early season weather kind of impacted things out there.
Yeah, I think almost anyone you talk to will say 2023 was a wild ride. I mean, certainly, and I mean, all of us, even early in the year, I mean, a lot of us were under flood warnings, thinking, I mean, dams could burst. We were getting so much snow and rain. It was a blessing. I don't think no one's going to turn down rain, right? But it certainly added some issues right at the start of our season. So we both had some of the different disease issues from that. We had greener hills, which is great, but it also means a lot more pests moving into crops when those hills dry down. So certainly in almonds, simple one, lots of botrytis, lots of jacket rot, lots of Monlinia, a lot of the bloom diseases in areas that generally don't get them. So it caught a few people by surprise. Then after that, in the summer, we still had some moisture, so we had heavy alternaria. We had heavy spring diseases. So they were fighting through that while leaf-footed plant bug was coming in, causing issues to their nuts, and stink bug was coming in. So they were kind of getting hit from every angle. And finally, you know, it was coming close to hull split. They were planning their NOW sprays. They were getting ready to finish out. And then we got some areas got a late rain. So there were nuts on the ground during that. There were nuts in the trees. Hull rot popped up out of nowhere. You could drive by and see trees with 50% strikes, just dead branches from how much hull rot came in. And then the nuts started coming off in the almonds, and unsurprisingly, tons of NOW injury, higher than usual ant injury, partly because some people were cutting out some of their ant spreads. So, I mean, it went anywhere from still single digits for injury, which isn't great, but that's what you want to see, especially under 2%. It was more common around 5 or 6, and as wild as it sounds, I'm hearing reports from up north, 30 to 50% in some fields. That's nearly a complete loss if you're losing 30 to 50% of your crop to injury. So it has been quite the wild ride. And I think a lot of people have kind of had to recalibrate themselves to proper IPM strategies, proper timings, proper application, and everything else that comes about from that. So yeah, just almonds alone with how the weather worked out has just been wild.
In terms of some of the almond damage, was there any kind of maybe geographical indicator as to where maybe some spots got hit a little bit harder, or was it fairly spread across the board throughout California?
Many times in the more southern portions, say Kern County, you're not going to see as much bloom disease, but that wasn't the case this year. It came up heavy, both Monolini and jacket rot. And then later on, a lot of the injury, especially some of the insect injury like NOW or leaf-footed plant bug, a lot of it came down to people trying to sharpen their pencils. And unfortunately, they chose to cut some sprays to save some money, whereas trying to kind of, you know, maximize their profit, maximize their crop by properly applying and properly timing. So I think people took the gut approach of, hey, let's cut some sprays. And unfortunately, now that everything's coming off the tree, they're noticing that you may not want to do that in a year like this.
And kind of looking ahead as to, you know, the expectation is for another fairly wet winter. So I'd imagine that the suggestion there is maybe don't try to cut corners or cut costs there if we deal with another wet winter like we just did.
I would say plan ahead. That's the biggest thing. I mean, everyone's still trying. I mean, prices have gone up some, which is great. People are happy, but people are still sharpening their pencils, making a good plan. And I think the biggest thing is have a good plan. Certainly have some places to pivot, either reducing a spray, adding a spray, going less intense or more intense. You have options now. So I think that's the big thing. Certainly coming out of a wet winter with, or a wet season with a lot of disease, there's a ton of inoculum out there. So you may want to plan ahead for, especially in almonds and really all of our crops, that disease is going to be a bigger issue than normal. And especially if we have a wet winter, I mean, conditions are going to be very prevalent to it. So I think everyone just has to plan ahead. I think now that people are seeing some of the injury, both to their trees and to their yields, I think a lot of people are starting to think more, let's be strategic. It's really easy to spend yourself broke, but you also can't save yourself to prosperity. So you really have to plan ahead and how best do I manage my crop for the future.
Thank you again to Brian German for today's interview segment. This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and now for more agriculture news. Bayer confirmed in an investment call this week the company is considering splitting business units following poor financial results. According to Bayer CEO Bill Anderson, who said, quote, "We are redesigning Bayer to focus only on what's essential for our mission and getting rid of everything else." Anderson, who has been at the company's helm since June, says by the end of next year, Bayer will remove multiple layers of management and coordination. The company ruled out splitting into three divisions, but other options remain. Anderson adds, quote, "In terms of structural options, beyond maintaining three divisions, a separation of either consumer health or crop science remains under evaluation." Sales in the agricultural business were level year on year at 4.3 billion euros. High volumes in all regions were mostly offset by lower prices for glyphosate-based products. Corn and seed traits rose by 21.2%, while fungicides were up 16.2%. The soybean seed and traits business likewise posted double-digit percentage growth of 15.6%. The contrast, sales at herbicides were down by 17.3%. A new pilot program is designed to widen access to tribal bison meat producers to a USDA food purchase program and local and regional food system markets. Rod Bain has details.
Among the barriers some tribal bison meat producers face in participating in USDA's food distribution program on Indian reservations, the timing of USDA purchase of ground bison meat versus traditional harvest periods, requirement of a minimum full truckload of meat for purchase, and inspection by USDA and state officials. Agriculture Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Jenny Moffitt says those concerns are being addressed through a new pilot program.
What this program means to them, just the importance of being able to sell into a program that is feeding their own community, feeding their own nation, feeding their own tribe, the ability for this program to be another part of market access that they haven't had before.
Not just through USDA food programs, but other local and regional food system customers, such as local restaurants, grocery stores, and institutions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Wind damage is a common concern for farmers, and it's hard to know how much was lost until the combines roll out, while new technology may make that easier for them. David Geiger has this report.
Geospatial technology is a way to find out more about the fields, and accurate GPS coordinates combined with yield monitor data can now let scientists find out how much damage a windstorm may have caused. Amar Bhandari with USDA's Agricultural Research Service says it's simple technology. He saw recent wind events and wanted to check it out.
We use a simple GPS unit to locate the wind damage points inside the field and connected that information with the yield monitor system, which many of our farmers already use that with the combine during harvesting. And then we use that system to estimate the potential yield and economic loss.
This technology allows for a site-specific reference tool. Bhandari says the model they used found that for every 1% of wind damage in a cornfield, there were 26 pounds, or half a bushel, of production loss per acre. Now, prices have decreased about 29% since they used November 2022 USDA corn prices. So with that in mind, his research found, on average, wind damage was about a $76 an acre loss for 25% or less damage, or a $232 loss per acre for 75% or more damage.
However, we need to be mindful that the wind speed and other field conditions will determine the extent of the damage in the field, right? And there are so many factors, and these numbers may vary from one location to another location.
Bhandari says in recent years there have been abnormal weather patterns, so it's important to find different ways to quickly find out the damage done.
And that's where we come up with these simple techniques to determine the field damage and how we can get that information to the producers and other stakeholders in decision making to prepare for unprecedented severe wind storms and its impact on crop damage in the future.
Because of natural disasters impacting farmers, Bhandari wanted to help, especially with recent severe wind storms around the Midwest. He worries about the extent of damage that may go unknown. He is interested in making the best out of a bad situation by making sure farmers have a clear picture.
And it is important to note that, you know, farmers may not be able to see the extent of the damage just by driving along the edges of the corn field, because the damage might have occurred deep inside the field, which we observe in our study as well. And farmers might mistakenly believe their field did not suffer the damage. So, you know, we need to be cautious.
Again, Amar Bhandari with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service. I'm David Geiger.
The Fertilizer Institute this week reiterated its opposition to the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed rule to tighten national ambient air quality standards for fine particulate matter. The organization also voiced support for legislation to prohibit the EPA altering the standard at this time. TFI President and CEO Corey Rosenbusch says only 2 years ago the EPA confirmed that the current standard is protective of public health and the environment. He added they have not provided any reasoning as to what has changed in the past 2 years, aside from the fact that these emissions continue to decline. According to the government's own data, fine particulate matter emissions have declined by more than 40% over the last 20 years, and they continue to go down. Additionally, the current rule balances environmental protection with robust commercial and industrial activity. TFI was joined by more than 70 other industry groups in a letter articulating the economic impact the rule they say would have, as well as what they call faulty reasoning behind the change. The latest USDA cotton crop report is out. Here's Becky Summer with more.
All cotton production is forecast at 13.1 million 480-pound bales, up 2% from the previous forecast, but down 10% from 2022. Based on conditions as of November 1st, yields are expected to average 783 pounds per harvested acre, up 16 pounds from the previous forecast, but down 167 pounds from 2022. All cotton area harvested is forecast at 8.02 million acres, unchanged from the previous forecast, but up 10% from 2022. By October 29th, 49% of the nation's cotton acreage was harvested, 5% behind last year, but 2% ahead of the five-year average. This is Becky Summer with the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service.
That is today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.